June 23rd, 2025. Hey, Future Me. Someone said today the Third World War has begun. And in that moment, everything around me paused. My mind froze. Am I ready to die? It wasn't about being afraid of dying. I've always thrown bold lines like, I'm not afraid to die on a treadmill and other extremes. But being ready. No, I'm not ready. I haven't lived yet. I haven't experienced love, real love, the kind that's worth every second. I haven't known the pain of giving birth, or the overwhelming joy of holding a baby for the first time. I haven't stood on mountaintops watching the sunset in complete awe. I haven't spent enough time with the people I love. I haven't reached my dreams, not even close. I haven't become the human being I know I'm supposed to be. I haven't done enough good. No, I'm not ready to leave this earth. Not yet. Not now. There's still so much living left to do. So much has happened since the last episode on May 29th, 2025. The world felt like it was on the edge. We were almost pulled into a third world war. And at the same time, my own world was shifting. I passed one of my final exams in medical school, dermatology, one of the last I'll ever take. And just before that, something wild happened. I trained for and ran for the very first trail run of my life. 18 kilometers through the stairs, the streets, and hills of Algiers. It was unforgettable. I met amazing people. I felt adrenaline pumping through my veins. I felt the joy of running in my city, of rediscovering it for the first time, but through movement, through pain, through pure effort. And yes, it hurt, especially in those last few kilometers, and especially when climbing endless flights of stairs with an injured knee. A knee I had injured during the preparation, by the way. But I kept going. And honestly, I think that run taught me just as much about life as anything else has in the past few months. Let me tell you about it through the letters I wrote in the middle of all that. June 26, 2025. One day before the trail. Hey, future me. Today I realized I've taken my health for granted. I've taken the pain-free joints. The pain-free body, the easy movements, all of it, for granted. I didn't appreciate the days I trained without pain the way I should have. I thought they would always be there. I thought my body would always follow. Until I got injured. Until I realized that waking up pain-free, moving freely, running without thinking was never a guarantee, but a blessing. Now, every pain-free movement feels like a prayer answered. The simple hope of being able to run one more day, to chase that trail one more time, becomes everything I think about, everything I pray for. We only understand the value of ease once it's gone, don't we? And here's another one. June 30, 2025. Hey, future me. I woke up this morning, but all I wanted to do was go back to sleep. Go back to that strange, beautiful dream I had, where I was standing in the middle of a crowd. People from every age, every background, every story. And yet somehow, almost all of us were wearing the same blue shirt. All of us running, together. I wanted to go back to that dream, where people were cheering us on. Where little kids stretched out their hands for high fives, where water bottles floated down from the clouds, or were they coming from the windows? I'm not even sure anymore. I wanted to go back to that moment, where people suddenly stopped, started dancing, singing, shouting together. I wanted to go back to that dream, Dunya. It was a dream, wasn't it? It really was wonderful. That day, that moment. I would give anything to go back. But now, we must move forward, don't we? In the last episode, I said I wanted to start learning how to manage my thoughts, how to be more optimistic, how to believe again in life, in dreams, in hope. But here's the truth. I've never been into the whole law of attraction, energy vibrations, telepathy kind of thing. It always felt off, abstract. Like, I just didn't get it. Faith, I understood, thank God. But everything else was too blurry. I used to feel like I was stuck in the pre-operational stage of development. Like a child who couldn't grasp abstract ideas. They just didn't make sense to me. Until the beginning of this year. It started with these strange moments. I'd think of someone, or feel something about them. And the next day, I'd see them. Or they'd message me out of nowhere. Even if I hadn't heard from them in months. And the strangest was this dream. About someone I barely knew. Someone I just used to say hi to at the gym. In that dream, I was worried. Asking them, are you okay? Everything good? And the very next day, I saw them again. But they weren't training. Actually, they couldn't train. They had a car accident earlier that week. How did I know? What was that? And then, not long after, I had a long, beautiful conversation with one of my mentors. She told me how she met her husband and how two different people with no connection to each other led her to the exact same person at a time when she wasn't even looking for love. That person just appeared. That moment just happened. I know some people would say it's destiny, that it was written. And I believe in that. But I also believe in tying your camel first. When the Prophet ﷺ was asked, should I tie my camel and trust in Allah, or should I leave her untied and trust in Allah? The Prophet ﷺ replied, tie her and trust in Allah. You don't just sit and wait for the stars to align. You move, you act, you try, and then you trust. But still, all this talk about fate and energy and manifestation always felt too abstract, too distant, too far from my reality. Until now. Until I started wondering, maybe I've been missing something. Especially when I looked back and realized how much negativity I'd been living in the past few years. How much I'd stopped dreaming. How much I'd become like Charlie Munger, expecting little so as never to be disappointed. In the book Snowball, the biography of Warren Buffett, the author described this about him. He had developed the habit of expecting little so as never to be disappointed. Munger's mental habit of setting low expectations was well established. He equated this with the route to happiness, since he felt that high expectations led to fault finding. Low expectations made it harder to be disappointed. But where Munger found peace in that, I found sadness, disappointment, disconnection. I wasn't protecting myself, I was burying myself. And as I said in episode 11, I decided I was done. I had to change my mindset. If not, I'd spend the rest of my life surviving instead of living. And in that moment, I remembered this book, Reality Transurfing by Vadim Zeeland. It had popped up in a podcast with Iman Godsey, who said it helped him go from zero to $50 million. At the time, I thought it was a business book. But why did it come back to me now, during one of the most spiritual, emotional moments of my life? I don't know. Maybe because that's what I needed. Maybe because if I'm going to explore this whole world of energy, vibrations, intentions, fate, I should start with a book that wouldn't leave my mind. I mean, if even quantum physicists are writing about it, maybe there is something I've been blind to all along. I was woken up by the neighbor's dog barking. The nasty animal was always waking me up. How I hated it. Why should I have to be woken up by the noise of someone else's pet? I decided to go out for a walk, calm down. I was so fed up of everything. Every time I tried to battle with the world, it would at first yield, giving me false hope, only then to come back at me with a hard slap. I was so tired. I realized that the feeling of tiredness never left me. Even when I was relaxing, I was always waiting for things to change, for a new stage in my life to begin, where I would be different and able to enjoy life. But that stage was always somewhere in the future. I would return home and do the same thing I always did. Eat a boring breakfast and then leave for my dull job, forcing myself to produce results which mattered to someone else but not to me. It would be just another day of the same tiresome, meaningless life. And I mean, this hit so deep, especially because in the months before picking up that book, I was starving for something new, something meaningful, something different. I kept hoping that life would surprise me, that it would give me a sign, a shift, a spark. But instead, it was just the same old routine, the same roads, the same faces, the same thoughts. And I was so fed up, so tired of waiting for something to change, while feeling like I was drowning in stillness. It felt like I was stuck on repeat, emotionally, spiritually, even physically. Every day I felt further from who I wanted to be. And the scariest part was I wasn't even sure who that person was anymore. I was woken up by the rustle of the morning stars. What a sad dream. It was as if I had returned to a period in my past. Thank goodness, it was only a dream. I had placed an order for a sunny day and so set off towards the sea. I felt comfortable and at peace, as if the overpopulated world had created a secluded corner just for me. Some people believe the world is an illusion created by the mind, but I could not imagine having such a high opinion of myself, that I could think all this beauty was the product of my own consciousness. Still, feeling the effect of my oppressive dream, I began to reminisce about my former life, which had actually been as dull and gloomy as my dream. Like a lot of people, I had often demanded that the world give me all I felt it owed me, but in response it had turned its back on me in indifference. I was advised by others wiser and more experienced than myself not to give up because the world doesn't give up that easily either. So I tried battling with the world, but I didn't get anywhere and ended up exhausted. My advisors had a ready answer for this too. You are the problem. Change yourself before you start demanding things of life. So, I battled with myself, but this turned out to be even harder than battling with the world. And again, this part hit home too, because at some point, when you've been surviving day after day, when you've started changing the world around you, even reshaping parts of yourself, you begin to wonder, could life really be different? And if it could, is it worth waiting for? Or maybe this is it. Maybe you're meant to live this way, stuck in the loop, always hoping for something better that never really comes. It's a quiet kind of exhaustion, a doubt that settles deep in your bones. And I think that's the perfect segue into what comes next, fate. There are different interpretations of the nature of fate. One interpretation is that fate is your lot in life, something predetermined and which, however hard you try, you can never escape. This definition is rather limiting, as it suggests that if a rough lot has befallen you in life, there is no hope of anything ever getting any better. In transurfing, the concept of fate is based on an alternative model of the universe. Before you wave your hand in disappointment and decide that you are being fed yet another chimera, remember that every known concept of fate originates from a specific worldview, which in turn is based on a number of unproven principles. For example, materialism is founded on the proposition that matter is primary and consciousness is secondary. Idealism claims the opposite. Neither of these philosophies has been proven, and yet models of the universe are constructed around both. I decided to keep that analogy because honestly, it was one of the things that made me want to keep reading. It made me stop and think, there really are so many different worldviews, so many frameworks people live by. Some believe in science, others in faith, some in logic, others in energy, vibrations, or manifestation. And somehow, life still unfolds for each of them. Things still work out. The pieces still fall into place. Not always easily, not always perfectly, but they make sense in their own way. And that made me wonder, what if there's truth in all of them? What if life really is about choosing the lens that fits you and learning to see beauty through it? So maybe, just maybe, if I gave transurfing a real shot, I could start seeing life through a new lens too. A version of life that made sense, not because it was flawless, but because it finally felt beautiful. There's a well-known parable about three blind men who describe an elephant by studying it with their hands. The first blind man touches the elephant's trunk, the second touches the leg, and the third touches ear. Each draws conclusions about what kind of animal the elephant represents based on their own findings. After every fight on the intellectual battlefield for truth, just one fact remains undefeated. Every theory represents a separate aspect of the phenomenon of a multifaceted reality. What you choose is what you get. Whatever worldview you choose to believe in, the truth of that worldview will always be on your side, and others will argue with you because they too are right. So the first lesson is simple, but absolutely powerful. What you choose is what you get. The world is vast, full of layers, meanings, contradictions. There are 1,000 ways to explain a single event, and 1,000 beliefs that could shape the same reality in completely different ways. But here's the truth. Whatever you choose to believe, whatever narrative or rule you adopt to make sense of your life, will shape your experience. It will become true for you. It mirrors the wisdom of Confucius, who once said, "He who says he can and he who says he can't are both usually right." That's the power of belief, of perspective, of choice. And the second lesson, which flows naturally from the first, is this. All of this is not necessarily irrational. It's not magic. It might actually be science. As Vadim Zeeland explains, this isn't just about wishful thinking. It's rooted in logic, in systems, in physics. For example, quantum physics is based on a number of unproven truths and postulates which cannot be proven because they serve as the basic starting point for a given field of knowledge. In quantum physics, a microcosm sometimes acts as a particle and sometimes as a wave. If in describing the microcosm one chooses to start with its particle quality as fundamental, then one arrives at the model of the atom. If, on the other hand, one takes the main quality to be the wave, then the model of the atom will look like a blurry dot. Both models work, reflecting different manifestations of reality. The alternative space is a material information structure. It is an infinite field containing information in all possible scenarios of any event that could ever possibly take place. One could say that the alternative space contains absolutely everything. Now I know, this is starting to sound like we're in the middle of a Marvel movie. Multiverses, alternate realities, quantum physics. But hey, if you're into sci-fi or even just a tiny bit into physics, some of this probably makes a strange kind of sense, doesn't it? And that brings us to lesson 3, which builds on everything we've been talking about. Life is made up of lifelines, different paths, different realities, each leading to a different version of the life you could live. For the ease of understanding, let us say that each variation or version has a script and scenery. The scenery is the external form of a phenomenon, whereas the script is the path that matter moves along. Theoretically speaking, there are no limits to the scripts and sceneries of human existence, because the alternative space is infinite. Any seemingly insignificant event can't affect a twist of fate. A person's life, just like any other movement of matter, represents a chain of cause and effect events. In the alternative space, the effect is always located in close proximity to its cause. One follows the other, and so the sectors of a person's destiny create a lifeline. I know all of this is pretty confusing, but hey, I promise it's gonna get way clearer. Experiencing lifelines placed very close together is like watching a play, and then the next day go into the theater again to see the same play, but this time the stage scenery is different. If during the next theater season you saw the play with the same actors, but there had been significant changes to the script, this would be like experiencing a lifeline situated slightly further away in the alternative space. Finally, if you watch the same production in a different theater, you would see a totally different interpretation of the play, and this would be like experiencing a lifeline that exists a significant distance from the first. As you might have guessed, the play is actually your life, and the scenery and the script are what makes your life, I guess. Anyways, lesson 4 dives even deeper. It explains how different alternatives, different realities begin to materialize in our lives. How our lifelines aren't just random, but shaped and created by the choices we make, the energy we give, and the thoughts we allow to grow. The alternative space serves as a template that determines how physical reality can show itself. Imagine a person walking through a dark forest with a torch. In the dark, the person holding the torch lights up a small area around themselves. The entire forest is like the alternative space, while the area which is lit up is like the physical manifestation of the alternative in that area. The question remains as to what provides the light. In other words, what ignites, i.e. materializes, a particular alternative within the template? To answer this question, we need to take a different starting point. Nowadays, most people agree that thoughts are material. Therefore, thoughts not only provide the motivation for human action, they also have a direct influence on our reality. For example, our worst expectations generally tend to come true. This reminds me of something that Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, words to the effect of, expect good and you will find it. And maybe that's exactly what explains those moments, you know, the ones when you think about someone and suddenly you receive their message, or you run into them by pure coincidence. It's as if our thoughts are seeds quietly shaping what blooms around them, as if expecting good gently opens the door for it to find its way to us. Lesson 5 reminds us that almost everything around us is a pendulum, an energy we either feed or free ourselves from. Every conversation, every trend, every opinion, it's all a swinging force trying to pull us in. We are taught from childhood to obey the will of others, to perform our duties, serve our country, our family, the company we work for, a political party, the state, or even an idea. All these structures emerge and develop when a separate group of people begin to think and act in the same way. On an energetic level, however, a structure appears when a group of people think in the same way, as a result of which the parameters of their thought energy are identical. Their thought energy finally unites into a single current, which is the pendulum. The structure is referred to as a pendulum because the more people that feed it with their energy, the more powerfully it sways. If a person is lucky, they find their place within the system and feel at home there. If, however, a person has ended up a long way from a lifeline favorable to their growth, life inside the structure of an alien pendulum can be as soulless as hard labor, or just turn into a very sad existence. The most important thing is to be able to recognize a pendulum and avoid being drawn into it and drawn into its game unless you stand to benefit from the interaction. It does not matter to the pendulum which side you rock it from. It can use both positive and negative energy, just as long as the energy is resonant with its own. The feeling of guilt is also one of the most extensive. The strongest ring the pendulum can pull you with is fear, the most ancient and powerful of human emotions. The feeling of guilt is also one of the most extensive of channels through which the pendulum can pump your energy. Guilt is hard to live with, and so people try to get rid of it, either via punishment or righting the wrong they have done. Both imply submissions, obedience, and a certain thought pattern. To owe something means that you are in some way guilty and therefore obliged to do something. And then he says that one of the ways to get rid of guilt is either not to do wrong, not to get yourself into doing wrong things, or to just say sorry and try to make better things in the future. And soon afterwards, forgetting the guilt and letting go of it and not getting attached to it in order not to be manipulated and in order not to swing with the pendulum. Lesson 6 is a game changer. It's about how your thoughts about an event, not the event itself, can completely shift the lifeline you're on. Two people can go through the exact same thing, but the one who sees possibility, who chooses to respond instead of react, ends up on a very different path. It's not about what happens to us. It's about how we meet what happens to us. That's what determines the story we step into next. For example, generally we let information about accidents and disasters pass us by. If we are not directly affected, why upset ourselves unnecessarily? As a rule, when you hear the news, a disaster is taking place somewhere in the world, but you are on a lifeline where you play the role of witness rather than victim. The line on which you are the victim is somewhere further away. Conversely, if you allow yourself to take on board information about disaster and misfortune and discuss it with friends, it is quite possible that you will soon shift to a lifeline where you may well end up in the role of the victim. I feel like this is a lesson that I should keep in mind, because most of the time I try to put myself in positions where I am the victim instead of being just a witness, and when I should be just a witness. Actually, and this is going to be said afterwards, every problem we have is because we put too much importance in something. And if we start to act as a witness rather than a victim, then we could detach from the problems and solve our problems much more easily. Anyways, lesson 7 is one of the hardest to accept. The more you desperately want to voice something, the more you end up drawing it into your life. Why? Because intense fear is still focus. And where focus goes, energy flows. It's like the universe doesn't hear, "I don't want this." It only hears what you're obsessing over. Exactly like the classic example of "don't think about the elephant." And boom, that's all you can think about, right? He says, the stronger you desire to avoid something, the more likely it is that you will encounter it. To actively fight against what you do not want in your life is to make every effort to ensure that it is present in your life. You do not have to take any specific action to shift onto undesired lifelines. It is enough to think negative thoughts and then fertilize them with emotion. The first and most important condition for successfully defeating a pendulum is to refuse to get into conflict with it. Secondly, you do not have the right to judge or change anything. Everything you see and experience should be accepted as if they were paintings on display, whether you like them or not. There may be many paintings in an exhibition that are not to your taste, but it would never occur to you to demand that they be removed from the exhibition room. Once you have recognized the pendulum's rights to exist, you also have the right to leave it behind, remaining free from its influence. Lesson 8 is about letting go. This one hit me hard. Because letting go is hard. It is extremely hard. But letting go isn't about giving up. It's about releasing the desperate grip we have on outcomes, on control, on needing things to happen a certain way. He says, before you can fully understand what it means to choose, you have to know how to decline. To decline something, you have to first accept its existence. The word accept in this context does not mean to embrace something and let it into your personal space. It means simply to recognize its right to existence and then pass by indifferently. This is much more effective than letting something into your personal space, becoming attached to something, and then trying to oppose it. A basic example of this would be a dog that starts following you and barking loudly. If you turn around to face the dog, it will bark even louder. And yet, if you take it seriously and start trying to dodge it or fight it, the dog will follow you for a long time, just because it wants something to lock horns with. If you ignore the dog from the outset, it will simply switch its attention to someone else and will not be at all offended that you paid it no attention. Lesson 9 is about solving complex problems with simple solutions. And that's the thing we talked about previously. The way to avoid getting caught in the pendulum snare is to keep whatever problem you are dealing with in perspective and remain aware of the pendulum's intent to trick you into playing its game. Rent yourself out, be detached. Try looking at the situation as if you had no emotional attachment to it. Act as you normally would, but remain observant. Don't play the game. Lesson 10 is about what happens when you let go. This one touched something deep. When you finally let go of the people who no longer show up, the problems that drained your soul, the worries you held into like lifelines, Something strange and beautiful happens. Life flows again. But that also means you might feel empty. He says, when you have disentangled yourself from the influence of destructive pendulums, you acquire a newfound freedom. But if you do not have a goal to focus on, you can find yourself hanging in a suspended state. Events that before had you at the center of things now carry on without you. You are no longer as important to other people around you as you used to be, and so they pay you less attention. It is essential to recognize the goals you have been conditioned to chase after, which in fact lead you further away from your lifeline of happiness. The task is then to remain free and choose those lifelines on which true success and happiness await you. Do energetic structures exist that do not require energy? It turns out they do. One is the wave of fortune, or set of circumstances that are favorable to you personally. The wave of fortune will carry into happy lifelines. Like the pendulum, the wave has no interest in your fate, but it has no need of your personal energy either. If you want to, you can float with the wave and let it carry you. But if you do not want to go with the wave, it will pass you by with no regret. Lesson 11 is about choosing optimism, always. Instead of playing the game of a destructive pendulum, seek out pendulums that benefit you in some way by their game. Acquire the habit of giving your attention to all that is positive and good. As soon as you see, read, or hear something pleasing or encouraging, hold it in your thoughts and let it lift your spirit. Let in the things that are positive and you will be greeted on your path by ever more good news and auspicious opportunity. The more negative your thoughts about life, the worse your life will become. The more a person worries about failure, the more readily new failures will appear in their life. As the saying goes, as the call, so the echo. This is so deeply relatable. This is one of the hardest things for me to do because for so long, I've believed, maybe like you, that if I hold on too tightly to joy, if I look at beauty too directly, if I speak of good things out loud, they might vanish, disappear, slip through my fingers like sand. So I tried not to get too happy, tried not to dream too big, tried not to expect too much. Because if the good ever left, at least I wouldn't break. And I wasn't always this way, you know? This mindset, the one where I shy away from dreaming too much, from hoping too hard, it started in middle school. I remember that final exam year so vividly. I was all in. I studied like my life depended on it. Focus, discipline, I sacrificed time, friendships, joy, everything. I wanted one thing, a 19 out of 20. And that was the number I told myself would prove I was enough. And yet, despite everything I did, I didn't get it. It was a great grade, alhamdulillah, but not what I dreamed of. As if that disappointment wasn't enough, a few weeks later, I was in the hospital with appendicitis. Felt like a betrayal, like the universe had said, even your best is not enough. That was the beginning of that mindset. The first time I felt that good things could vanish just when you get close enough to touch them. That they could vanish no matter what you did. And I told myself, never again. Yet still, in high school, I tried to fight back. I summoned the strength to dream again. To reach for another 19. For the last exam of high school. I mean, I get it. Like, exams aren't really a metric of success. Of achieving a dream, but I was too small to understand that. Too immature, maybe. So I summoned the strength to dream again and to reach for another 19. But again, I didn't get it. Again, a beautiful score, thank God, but still not what I'd hoped for. And this time it hurt more because I'd hoped harder. So I started to believe maybe dreaming jinxes the dream. Maybe if I stop hoping, I'll stop hurting. So I stopped expecting, I started bracing. Because if you don't get too happy, maybe it won't hurt as much when it all disappears, right? But as Vadim says, the more negative your thoughts about life, the worse your life will become. The more a person worries about failure, the more readily new failures will appear in their life. As the saying goes, as the call, so the echo. Lesson 12 is about balance, about energy, and about how sometimes, without realizing it, we make our own lives heavier than they need to be. Vadim Zeeland explains that imbalance often comes from something he calls excess potential, which is really just too much importance. We give too much weight to things, to people, to achievements, to emotions. We obsess, we cling, we fear, and all that excess energy throws our whole life out of harmony. It creates resistance, blocks flow, invites struggle. He says, everything in nature strives towards balance. Change in air temperature are balanced by wind. Differences in temperature are compensated by thermal exchange. Wherever there is excess potential of any energy form, balanced forces emerge to correct the imbalance. Now, what is the source of excess potential? Excess potential is created by mental energy when too much importance is given to a particular object. On an energetic level, all material objects are of equal significance. It is we that attribute specific qualities to them. Everything in this world is subject to our assessment. From this lesson, we can derive so many examples, especially when it comes to work and ambition. Some people believe that if you devote yourself fully to your work, you will achieve excellent results. If you look at this point from the point of view of scales and balance, it is obvious that immersing yourself so heavily in work is like placing your work on one dish of the scale and absolutely everything else in the other dish. Naturally, balance is destroyed, and the consequences become visible all too soon. The result of prioritizing work to this extent will be the exact opposite of what you expected. This also applies for resentment of self. This feeling arises when a person is unfulfilled by their personal achievements and qualities and finds it hard to accept their own weaknesses. It is quite possible to be conscious of your own shortcomings without inflating them into a complex. If you are intensely focused on your own foibles, excess potential will be created. There is no point in trying to hide weaknesses, and overcoming them can be tricky. Trying to hide them only creates the opposite effect, which makes the situation even worse. All they have to do is lay down the heavy burden, be themselves, and then life would become noticeably easier and simpler. Energy can then be transferred from battling with imperfection to developing more worthy qualities, and the quality of this new energy would correspond to lifelines, where positive characteristics outweigh weaknesses. The final lesson, lesson 14, is about one of the hardest things to do as human. Not placing too much importance on people. Not idealizing, not depending, not clinging. It's about learning the art of unconditional love. A love that says, I see you, I cherish you, but I don't need you to complete me. So many of us fall into the trap of putting people on pedestals. I fall very frequently into this trap. We build them up in our minds. We wrap our worth around their presence, their attention, their validation. And when they leave, or change, or disappoint, we crumble. But as Vadim Zeeland explains, idealizing the world is the reverse side of the coin of dissatisfaction. When you idealize, the world things take on a rose-colored tint and much appear better than it really is. As you know, when a person sees something that is not really there, excess potential is created. However paradoxical it may sound, love is in essence dispassionate and unemotional. Unconditional love is admiration without worship or the need to possess. In other words, it does not create interdependent relationships between the one doing the loving and the object of the love. The simple truth helps to determine where love ends and idealization begins. Imagine walking through a mountain valley filled with greenery and flowers. You are thrilled by the incredible landscape. You breathe in the fresh air and aromas, and your soul is filled with happiness and tranquility. This is love. Then you begin to pick the flowers, gripping them in your hands, forgetting that they are alive. And the flowers slowly start to die. Later, it occurs to you that you could make perfume and cosmetics from the flowers, sell them, or even create a flower faith and worship them like icons. This is idealization. Love generates positive energy, which carries you into corresponding lifelines. Idealization, on the other hand, creates excess potential. If you want your love to be mutual, you have to love simply, without thought of whether you are loved or not. Besides, unconditional love is very rare and attractive quality, and so if you can embody it, you will automatically draw people to you. Would you not be drawn towards a person who loved you simply for the sake of it, without demanding anything in return? Still, on the subject of importance, the stronger you want something, the less likely you are to get it. When you want something so much that you are willing to place everything on the cards to get it, you create huge excess potential which destroys balance. Balanced forces can then throw you onto a lifeline where there is no trace of the object you desired. In the same way, when you think about the thing that you are negating, you radiate energy at the frequency of a lifeline where that thing is present. You always get the things you love to hate. In reality, this is what happens when you actively desire for something not to happen. Imagine a man attending a grand reception at an embassy. The atmosphere is formal, refined, and sedate. Then the man starts waving his hands about, uncontrollably stamping his feet and screaming desperately how much he would hate to be forced to leave immediately. Naturally, the security guys would appear forthwith, grabbing the strained guest under the arms. The man whines and tries to resist, but is nonetheless swiftly escorted out of the building. This is, of course, an exaggerated picture of reality, but on an energetic level, the dynamic of negative attachment has the same level of force and intensity. Two forms of importance exist, inner and outer. Inner or personal importance represents an overestimation of your own virtues or shortcomings. Outer importance is created when a person attributes huge meaning to an object or event taking place in the external world. Consequently, excess potential is created and things go wrong. The only way of eliminating outer importance is to have a safety net. The form the safety net takes will be subjective and depend on each situation. The most important thing is not to place everything on one side of the scales. There has to be some kind of counterbalance, protection, or alternative plan. All the importance we attribute to things, be it inner or outer, is simply a projection. No one is any of true importance in this world, and yet the riches of life are available to us. The only obstacle on the path to you fulfilling your desires is the projection of artificial importance. So maybe life isn't about trying harder. Maybe it's about choosing differently. Maybe it's not about controlling every outcome, but learning how to flow, how to release, how to walk with intention instead of tension. Reality transurfing didn't just give me a new perspective. It cracked open a door I didn't even know existed. It whispered, you don't have to fight for the life you want. You just have to shift to the version of you that already has it. And maybe the same is true for love, because if your thoughts can shape your reality, then what happens when your heart gets involved too? In the next episode, we'll dive into the invisible threats that pull us towards the people we crave. The patterns that keep repeating. The wounds that make us chase or run. And what it really means to attract the love we're ready for. But for now, take a breath, soften your grip, and remember, you don't need to force what's meant for you. You just need to become the version of you that it's meant for. So that is where I'll leave it. If you haven't yet subscribed to the podcast or YouTube channel, I'd really appreciate it if you did. Your support goes a long way in motivating me to keep chasing my hero and sharing this journey with you. Thank you so much for tuning in. And until next time, take care and keep chasing your hero.